You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sam.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Axiom of Choices album, Nia Yesh. The piece is called Chaos of Paradise. This is Persian crossover music, and we'll hear more of it today. While it might be off the front pages or the television headlines, the Iraqi refugee crisis continues in the greater Middle East. Today we'll talk to Sasha Crow, co-founder of the Collateral Repair Project, and Maha, an Iraqi refugee. Both talk to us from Amman, Jordan, later in the program. At this final NATO summit, NATO Secretary General Jaap de Hoop Scheffer claims that there are three major challenges facing the NATO alliance: Afghanistan, the relationship with Russia, in dealing with new threats such as cyber attacks, the interruption of energy supplies, security challenges such as the return of piracy and the implications of climate change, and the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. He believes that NATO is indispensable for today's world, saying the need for Europe and North America to tackle security challenges together remains as pressing today as it was 60 years ago. So does the need for a transatlantic institutional framework which allows for political consultation, joint decisions, and common action. Only NATO can provide this framework. For a different perspective, I welcome back to Raising Sand Radio Dr. Andrew Basevich, Professor of History and International Relations at Boston University. The paperback edition of his book, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, comes out this month. It's good to have you with us again, Dr. Basevich.
Oh, thank you very much.
So in the recent Los Angeles Times article, you write, "The creation of NATO in 1949 remains a singular example of enlightened statecraft." And in the same article, you continue, "Present-day NATO is a shadow of what it once was. Calling it a successful alliance today is the equivalent of calling General Motors a successful car company. It privileges nostalgia over self-awareness. As with GM, so too with NATO. Fixing past mistakes will require painful changes. Continuing along the existing trajectory is not an option. However counterintuitive, the best prospects for restoring NATO's sense of purpose and direction lies in having the U.S. announce its intention to exit the alliance." Say more about that.
I'd want to reference the grand claims made by the Secretary General of NATO that you quoted at the beginning of this segment. And I would simply want to say that as nice as the word, they represent a vast overstatement of what NATO is actually capable of doing today. And I think the central, my little op-ed, was to try to say that the United States should insist that NATO do what it's capable of doing and should give up any illusions that we can jawbone NATO into doing that which it's not willing to do. And I think that the Obama administration is following in the footsteps of the Bush administration in failing to meet or understand that essential point. To give a sort of a quick version of history here, NATO was founded to defend Europe against what seemed to be a looming threat, namely the Soviet Union. And people might disagree over how great that Soviet threat actually was, but certainly during the period of the Cold War, NATO accomplished its mission, and Europe remained at peace, and Europe recovered from World War II, and Europe became solidly, permanently democratic. When the Cold War ended, people said, well, we have to have a new mission for NATO. And NATO needs to go out of area, they said, or it was going to go out of business. That kind of thinking today has led to NATO being in Afghanistan, something far removed from its founding purpose. NATO in Afghanistan is performing very poorly. And I think that Obama, imagining that he can cajole the European members of NATO into doing more in Afghanistan, is kidding himself. And that if we really care about the survival of NATO, we should try to get NATO to return to its founding mission, which, as I said, is the defense of Europe.
And at the same time, you suggest that Europe can take care of its own problems at this point.
Well, that's the big difference between today and 1949, when the alliance was founded. I mean, in 1949, the democracies of Western Europe had been battered by World War II, and they needed assistance. And the United States, again, I think wisely, provided that assistance by joining NATO, and indeed really providing early on most of the muscle that made NATO a serious alliance. But the conditions of 1949 no longer pertain. Today, Europe is rich, it's stable, it's completely capable of handling its own security requirements. We have many demands made on our resources. We're in the midst of the worst economic crisis we've faced since the Great Depression, and it seems to me that it makes all the sense in the world for us to shed obligations that have become redundant, and the defense of Europe is one of those obligations, and we can afford to shed it because the Europeans are more than able to afford to defend themselves.
And MIT's Chomsky calls NATO an intervention force under U.S. command. He also asks, why should it exist? Well, actually, that's a different question to what you're asking. You're suggesting we exit the alliance, and he's suggesting it fold up shop.
No, yeah, I think he and I would disagree. I think that there is a need for NATO to continue, again, focusing back on its original mission. Now, I don't think that today's Russia is equivalent of the Soviet Union under Joseph Stalin, but I think it's not. It's quite, to be realistic about today's Russia, it's not a democracy. It may not be committed to the status quo in Europe. It has certain ambitions. It's got a certain amount of grudges that have accumulated over the past 20 years, and therefore, again, without trying to imply that we're on the verge of another war in Europe, there is a threat to European security. It's a threat that can be, I think, rather easily managed as long as the Europeans demonstrate a seriousness about defending themselves. And that's what NATO should be about. And it's a task that Europeans, not the United States, should shoulder.
Well, just on the purely practical side of politics, how would it look if Obama did announce an intention to exit the alliance?
Yeah, I mean, first, of course, he's not going to do that.
No.
I mean, my piece is, you know, it's just is the mainstream of American politics views NATO as something that necessarily has to exist from now until the end of time. But were we to exit NATO, I mean, the way to do it would not be to announce on Tuesday that we're going to leave on Thursday. The way to do it would be to announce on Tuesday that we're going to set a timetable to remove U.S. forces from Europe. And we should be willing to negotiate that timetable with our European partners. And this would be a process that would happen over a period of years, 5 years, 6 years, that would give our European allies time to adjust to a new reality in which they were not going to be able to count on the United States to provide for the defense of Europe, allow them time to ramp up their defenses as they would believe to be necessary, allow them time to assume a greater role in the in the staff structure, the command structure of NATO. So it would not be a precipitous withdrawal, but it would be one that would happen in a timely way over a period of probably several years.
And, but at the same time, then we would have to realize that we would not be able to depend on those the Europeans as allies when we want to do things as we have been doing in Iraq and
Afghanistan.
Well, but
I mean, I think that's exactly the point. I mean, first of all, NATO didn't go to Iraq. And secondly, to the extent that NATO has gone to Afghanistan, NATO's performance in Afghanistan has been mixed at best. I mean, if one could make the argument that NATO's presence in Afghanistan was so effective that it held the key to success in Afghanistan, then I guess you could make the argument that that this out-of-area posture made a lot of sense. But nobody is making an argument that NATO's performance in Afghanistan has been effective. It has been very problematic. And it's been problematic because several, not all, of the European nations from NATO that are involved in Afghanistan have been very reluctant to provide a sufficient number of troops, and they've placed all kinds of political constraints on the use of their troops, so that the bottom line is we don't really have an alliance in NATO. We have a collection of nations that are operating on different sets of rules. So what's the point of going down that path? That path is not producing effective results.
Well, one of de Hoop Scheffer's points is that the it allows a transatlantic institutional framework for political consultation. That is something that we need in the world, isn't it?
Sure. It's not clear to me why a military alliance is the framework within which such discussions have to occur.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are any number of other institutions. I mean, the G20 summit that just occurred in London would be an example of the kind of forum that permits transatlantic and other types of connections. So to withdraw from NATO is not say that somehow the United States is going to entirely sever its relations with Europe. That would be a silly thing to do. I'm simply saying that the alliance has gone down a path leading to dysfunction and ineffectiveness, and that we need to return the alliance to a path in which it will become useful again. To make it useful, the alliance should return to its founding mission of defending Europe. And the best way to get the Europeans serious about attending to that founding mission is to make it as clear as possible that it's their obligation to defend Europe, not our obligation. And we do that by turning NATO over to them.
Well, before we go, one last question. In your opinion, since the Second World War, where has NATO been the most effective?
In Western Europe. I mean, the founding purpose of NATO was, as it was said, I think it was by Lord Ismay, who was an early prominent figure in NATO. The founding purpose of NATO was to keep the Russians out, the Germans down, and the Americans in. And it accomplished all three of those purposes through the 1980s, and all three of those purposes were necessary. This is a different era. We don't have to worry about keeping the Germans down. The Germans are not going to go on the march again. They don't have to worry about keeping the Americans in, because they are sufficiently capable of managing their own affairs. There is still a need to keep the Russians out, as it were, to mount a serious defensive capability to ensure that the Russians aren't tempted to engage in any mischief. But again, they can manage that on their own today. They couldn't in 1949. In 2009, they're fully capable of taking care of that task.
It's Dr. Andrew Bacevich of Boston University. His book, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, comes out this month in paperback. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Bacevich.
Thank you very much for having me on the program.
And what came out of the NATO summit? Let's take a look at two different views. The first from the New York Times that reports, the Afghan war remains a dividing line for NATO alliance leaders. Despite a glowing reception and widespread praise for Mr. Obama's style and his aims, his calls for a more lasting European troop increase for Afghanistan were politely brushed aside, as they had been in negotiations leading up to the meeting. European allies agreed to provide up to 5,000 new troops for Afghanistan, but 3,000 of these are to be deployed only temporarily to provide security for the August elections in Afghanistan. A further 1,400 to 2,000 soldiers will be sent to form embedded training teams for the Afghan army and the police. Mr. Obama is raising the number of American troops this year to about 68,000 from the current 38,000, which will significantly Americanize the war. We in the United States have heard of first 17,000 and then an additional 4,000, so it's going to be interesting to see where these other numbers come from. So anyway, that was a report from the New York Times. Now let's take a view from the online journal antiwar.com, which states that NATO Supreme Commander General John Craddock warned that unless European allies like Britain send much larger forces of their own to the war-torn nation, the United States would be on the hook to provide the bulk of the troops in Afghanistan. Britain's 8,000-strong force is floundering in Helmand Province, and officials reportedly fear that unless the nation ups its commitment, the U.S. won't allow a British general to command NATO troops in the south next year. Still, Prime Minister Gordon Brown has promised only 300 additional troops. Getting commitments from other nations looks no easier. France has already denied reports that it is planning to participate in the U.S. surge, while Germany's General Amon has condemned that nation's participation in the war as a quote-unquote miserable failure. And keep in mind that the General Defense Ministry doesn't allow its officials to call it a war in Afghanistan. On another note, there's a new Secretary General of NATO, Denmark's Anders Fogh Rasmussen. This, despite Turkey's President Abdullah Gül strenuously vetoing this appointment. Turkey, the single big Muslim country within NATO, refused to yield on the appointment because of Rasmussen's defense of free speech during the Danish cartoon crisis 3 years ago, and because Denmark is host to a Kurdish rebel TV station broadcasting to Turkey. Speaking in London, Erdogan accused Rasmussen of playing host to quote-unquote terrorists linked to the PKK Kurdish guerrillas fighting in the Turkish state. Erdogan declared, "The mouthpiece of the terrorist organization in my country is broadcasting from Denmark. How can someone who did not stop this safeguard peace? NATO is an organization whose duties are to ensure peace." Nevertheless, Turkey yielded after the summit was extended by 2 hours and heads of state and government met alone to try and strike a deal. In the end, a European foreign minister reported that Turkey backed down when it was promised membership of the European Defense Agency, increasing Ankara's clout in the EU's defense affairs. The war in Iraq has displaced 1 in 5 Iraqis. Close to almost 1 million are in Jordan. In fact, risking a shameless plug for my book, Long Time Passing, Mothers Speak About War and Terror, which would be published next week, I write in reference to Iraqi refugees in Jordan that Jordan, with a population of 5.7 million, has admitted 800,000 Iraqis, the equivalent of France welcoming 8 million refugees, Germany taking in 11 million, or the United States taking in 40 million refugees. That's the kind of strain that Jordan is under. Meanwhile, Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, among the most bellicose of America's pro-war Arab allies, have accepted only a handful. Indeed, Saudi Arabia has closed its border with Iraq and is fortifying a $2 billion fence. With us today on Google Chat, the online telephone system, from Amman, Jordan, are Sasha Crow from the U.S. and Maha, an Iraqi refugee currently residing in Amman. Both are part of the Collateral Repair Project, an organization started at a kitchen table in Seattle in 2005. In 2007, Collateral Repair Project began working directly with the Iraqi refugee population. Collateral Repair Project was created to address the catastrophic displacement of 5 million Iraqis who've had to leave behind their homes and communities because of the violence and instability that is a result of the invasion and occupation of their country. The name of this organization, Collateral Repair Project, turns on its head the often used phrase collateral damage, a military euphemism commonly in use in our popular culture that refers to the inadvertent casualties and destruction inflicted on innocent civilians in the course of military operations. Instead, a Collateral Repair Project attempts to respond to the harm that had been caused by one's government. They respond by collaborating with injured persons and communities. Collateral Repair Project brings together the small, overlooked, incidental persons on both sides of the conflict who grieve. And CRP asks, what can we do? They assist in many ways with different types of emergencies, such as helping out with food for the hungry, rent when family is at risk of being evicted, utility payments when a family is at risk of shutoff, prescription medications, medical testing and modest price treatments or equipment, heating fuel, infant formula, blankets, warm clothing, transportation costs to important appointments, and so on. Again, I apologize for the audio quality. It's a bit tricky due to the inconsistencies of the online medium, but this is a small price to pay, I feel, for the important updates on the refugee crisis that Sasha Crowe and Maha share with our audience today. Sasha Crowe, co-founder of Collateral Repair Project, begins the section describing what CRP does.
Our primary projects are providing micro-projects, which are tools and equipment and supplies for people to be employed inside their homes and cottage industries. And this is really a necessary and important project because refugees as non-residents and only temporary guests in Amman and in Jordan are not allowed to work legally. And although some receive a small monthly cash grant from the UNHCR, it's not enough to take care of the family's basic needs. We also provide emergency assistance and many different things. We purchased coats for children this past winter. We provided stove oil and gas for people to heat their homes. We purchased heaters. We provided money for small surgeries, medicines, and right now we're doing a major drive of food distribution. We're providing a month's worth of basic commodity foods, oil, rice, sugar, beans, you know, basic foods for families for a month. And this is really helpful because there's no UNHCR food distribution any longer.
There is no more food distribution from UNHCR any longer? Is that what you just said?
No. What they did was that last year, I think because there was a lot of corruption in the food distribution system, instead they increased the grants to some families by maybe 10 JD, $14 a month, so they could buy their food, but that's not enough to feed a family. Like $14 is not enough to feed a family for a month. We're really filling a necessary gap there.
We haven't heard that much about what's going on in Jordan here in the news anymore. So talk about how Jordan is holding up with the refugee population. They were apparently overwhelmed a couple of years ago.
Well, I think Jordan is still overwhelmed. You know, the UN through international donors and then through partnering through some of the big organizations is providing for some of the needs. But only a small percentage of school-aged children have been funded to be able to attend public schools. There's certainly not enough funds to take care of medical needs of people. And because people can't work, you know, there's funding to provide, as I said, small cash grants for a lot of families, but not all of those that need it, not all of those that would qualify.
Are the refugees still coming to Jordan, or are people beginning to go back? What is the situation with the flow of people at this point?
I don't know if refugees are still coming. We've met, Maha, why don't you talk about this?
Yes, because the Jordanian government gave the Iraqis now more easier to enter the Jordan now for the medical cases, for the merchants, special for kinds of people, not all the people.
Uh-huh. So I know that it used to be that you'd have to have over $100,000 in the bank in order to come into Jordan. Now they've decreased that to $50,000. So that's encouraging more people that were unable to come in before, but still people with some means to come in.
Yeah.
But as Maha said, with special cases, if they can apply for and get a visa to come in, especially for temporary, but once they're here, many people, of course, choose not to return to the violence and chaos in Iraq. It's very dangerous there.
Yeah. Maha, can you talk a little bit about the day-to-day lives that people are facing in Jordan?
The Iraqi refugees' life is very bad here in Jordan because they can't work, especially the men, can't work here because they don't allow them to work, and any man who tried to work here in Jordan, maybe the Jordanian police will catch him and throw them on the border, so he will miss his family. And because all the men stay always at home, you know, the problems started between them and their wives, their kids. They started to get psychology cases. They started to hit their kids, and it became worse for their kids and their wives and for themselves. So you can see all the Iraqi families depend on only the salary from the UNHCR, and this salary only for some families, and there are many families who didn't get this salary. They paid for the rent and only few things, and they depend on the assistance from the others. But this assistance is very limited from the organization or from the other people, you know, they need and need.
We provided a micro project just today for a family, a husband and wife, and their four teenage and old, a little bit older children. The husband left and returned to Iraq. His passport was stamped. He cannot return back into Jordan because he just couldn't take it any longer. So last week he left. Many families are either leaving or contemplating leaving to return to Iraq, not because it's safer. It's certainly not safer there for them. So they just run out of resources and the means to cope here. Depression is rampant.
And so when you talk about this micro project, what will the family that's remaining, what will they be doing?
This particular family, we purchased for the woman a industrial sewing machine and an overlock sewing machine. So there's basic supplies, and she'll be subcontracting for a Jordanian shop that makes clothing. She'll be doing that in her home.
And that's legal. That's fine to do that.
It's on the edge, I think.
Oh, okay.
You know, she's not taking a job away from a Jordanian or Palestinian resident.
That's the criteria. If someone else can do the job that's already living there or a citizen there, then it goes to them.
Well, I don't know if that's exactly the criteria, but I think that's the intent behind it. That and Jordan is a very water-poor, resource-poor country. They're slated to run out of water within 15 years. And so they don't want to make life too comfortable here for Iraqis because they really can't handle this large influx that's moved into their population here.
And so what is it like socially for the Jordanians? Is there discrimination against the refugees, or are they accepting? How is that going?
It depends on the area that the Iraqi family live in. We if we will behave good, the others will be good with us. But no problems sometimes happen between them. But in generally, we are Arab, like each other, and good life here.
Like Mama was saying, it depends on the areas. And what we've noticed, especially in the poorer areas, where Iraqis and poor Jordanians and Palestinians are vying for jobs and vying for services, or vying for illegal work, I should say, under the table work. The children, especially in the schools, are bothered a lot by the Jordanians and the Palestinians here. They're teased unmercifully, sometimes by their teachers. So we, you know, you have to look at the fact that Jordan schools have been inundated with a lot of students with PTSD, traumatized kids who've missed several years of school. The classrooms have not been enlarged. Teaching staff has not been enlarged greatly. And so the teachers are under a lot of stress, too. It's a bad situation all the way around.
It's actually a similar situation then to what I heard about in Damascus, where the children are sometimes teased by their fellows, but also sometimes discriminated against by their teachers, because the teachers seem to feel that the kids are not speaking the right way. And so there's a lot of anxiety when the kids go to school over there in Damascus.
The same thing here. We visited a family yesterday whose children had left school last year. And so we encouraged them and provided support for them to return to the school and, you know, give them some emotional support and tips on how to deal with bullies. But one of the children is contemplating leaving school again because she's teased so badly.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to say teased, they say bullied. Really unfortunate because education is so important. I mean, this is one of the worst situations, is there's a whole generation of people who have either missed or lost out on their educations. When we're not only talking about young children, but we're talking about people who were in university in Iraq because education was free under the sovereign government that was there before. And they left Iraq. Many of them couldn't bring their transcripts with them, but now they cannot attend the university here and finish their education unless they have, you know, they're from a wealthy family. And so you have people who have no career skills in place. They can't work here. So you have young people are really suffering, along with, you know, as Maha said, the men. Everybody is suffering.
This is a fallout from war that we're not recognizing, that it actually goes on and will have and it will affect generations to come.
Right. And you have, you know, a lot of young men who are bored and frustrated and can't look forward to the future. Young people are not marrying because, of course, men cannot, you know, plan on how they're going to support a family. So, you know, this is going to trickle down and hit us in the backside, I think, in a few years when you have, if this doesn't change.
Sasha, how did you meet up with Maha?
Through a mutual friend. Collateral Repair Project, like I said, has been operating since 2005 on a much smaller scale, growing constantly. We met last year when I was looking for an Iraqi coordinator here, and Maha had been working on her own, as quite a few Iraqi, especially women, are, just contacting local wealthier Iraqis and gathering donations from them and trying to provide for the needs of some of her fellow country people. And so we were really pleased to hook up with her, and she's tremendous asset to this program.
So can you describe a regular day? You said today you did this a micro project funding, but what is that a general thing for you? Every day you do something like that, or what does a regular day look like?
Usually Maha and I meet in the morning, and for the last 2 months since I've been here this time, Maha calls families that she knows, or they call her because her phone number is a very hot item. She gets many calls as the word spreads that she has assistance, and plan to go to one area of this huge city and deliver food to as many families as we can in one day. So we'll load up the taxi with boxes of food and go from one family to the other, and we sit with them and not only, you know, hear about their food needs, but we hear about all of the challenges that they face, and Maha has many other resources. We put our heads together with them and try to do problem solving and meeting some of their needs. And so, like, we usually start out around 11 or 12 and then go until the evening.
And it's just the two of you, Sasha and Maha, doing this work?
Yes, we did have three other people working with us, but because of the economy and as all nonprofits, our donations have been cut back tremendously. So we don't have the funds to pay the other Iraqi staff that we didn't have working here. And in the U.S., it's myself and Mary Madsen in Medford, Oregon, who are co-directors in doing this.
And so you've been staying in Jordan now for several months?
Yes, I usually come here and stay for 3 months and then go back to the States for a couple of months and then return.
Uh-huh.
I think I'm much more effective here. Not so much as being a person on the ground to help carry the food boxes, but I think is being a tangible, you know, face of an American citizen who cares is very important and future peace building.
This is Raising Sand Radio at Stanford University's KZSU, FM 90.1. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, talking with Sasha Crowe and Maha in Amman, Jordan. Both represent the Collateral Repair Project based in Amman. Audio quality is a bit tricky due to the inconsistencies of the online medium, and thanks for staying with us to keep abreast of the Iraqi refugee crisis in the greater Middle East. Share with us some of the day-to-day difficulties that people talk about.
Always. First, the problem that the men couldn't work here. This is the first and the main problem for all the families. And we have many problems for the students and problems for the special cases and the medical assistance. We have here organizations that work on the medical assistance, but the large number of the Iraqis, they couldn't cover all of them, and they couldn't give them all the treatment that they need. Uh-huh. And it costs too much here, and the operations for the Iraqis, no organization for this thing, only the UNHCR. And many times we have very emergency cases at the night, but the units are closed at the night, so they have to go to the public hospitals, and they can't pay for the public, hospitals. Many, many problems, yeah. But we try to help.
You know, people can't afford their medications once they're given prescriptions, too. One of the families we visited today, the organization that helps them with their prescription only pays for 12 tablets a month, where this person actually uses 18 to 18 a day.
Yeah. Yes, they need more than they gave them.
And also another thing is that many mothers, new mothers, have problems breastfeeding because of stress, because of nutrition, and sometimes because medical professionals advise them to not breastfeed. Baby formula is incredibly expensive. And so we often run into mothers who are watering down the formula. This is an old problem we've heard about in other countries. So they could make the formula last a month. We really want to work on this issue. I think what we really need to have is groups of La Leche Dig or somebody come in and be with these mothers and support them in returning to breastfeeding. Best nutrition for their child and for the, because of the economic factor.
Is that something you're trying to have La Leche League get involved in? Have you approached them?
Well, I would love for them to get involved in it. Right now we're just doing some exploration on what's being done, and we do know that there's one clinic that provides medical services to Iraqis, and their doctors and their nutritionists there, support women, or they advise them to return to breastfeeding, but there's no support in place. I don't know if this is something Collateral Repair Project can do, but we're certainly seeing the need and trying to find somebody to fill it, putting out the word about this thing.
Was breastfeeding something that was widely accepted in Iraq?
That depends on the woman, but I think in Iraq, they depend on themselves not to buy the cans of milk. But now, because their bad health sometimes, or bad health of the baby, they have to keep it in the hospital for many days, and then he refused to take her mother milk. Yeah, in many causes here, and because here the bad feeding for the mother,
bad nutrition,
nutrition for the mother sometimes.
Yeah, pair that with stress and depression, and you have a mother who, like I said, healthcare professionals advising women to use formula.
There is another cause that of the family depend on the mother to work. Most of them had a very good degree, bachelor's or master, and they are now cleaning the homes or work very simple jobs to take money for the family. So she has to leave the baby at home with the father or the kids, and she will need the cans of milk.
Yeah. And the reason that women are if they can find this type of work or doing it rather than the men working, because the men are highly at risk of being caught and forcibly repatriated back into Iraq if they're caught working. So it's much safer for the women. And Iraqis have their own distinct accent. The Arabic is different than Jordanian. They don't just blend in invisibly. And as soon as they open their mouth, people know they're from Iraq.
What happens to the folks that fall through the cracks if they're not reaching out, or, you know, there's ill health or depression or something and they're not reaching out as much as they might? What happens to those folks?
Of course, they will get many diseases, and they will need more treatment than the milk itself or the simple things that they need now.
Yes. I mean, people are dying. Children, we've known several families whose children have died of cancer, preventable death, you know, because it just wasn't treatment available to them. And like we said in the beginning, too, is many people are contemplating or returning to Iraq. You know, I've heard several people say, I'd rather die on my home soil. It's very heartbreaking to witness and experience every day.
How do you hold up, Maha and Sasha?
I think for me, and I'll speak for me first, is doing this work is what keeps my psyche, my spirit alive, because making even a small impact, improving things just in the smallest way, you know, we focus on that rather than focusing on only what can't be done. You know, we're constantly thinking about what can we do. Mm-hmm. And so for me, this gives me heart and energy to continue. And Maha, I think, has a totally different experience because she is one of these Iraqis. She does not have legal residency, so she's in the same boat in many ways as many of the people we help.
Because we don't have anything to do, only to wait. But all the Iraqi psychology is very bad now, and most of them now the organizations here send them to the psychology to take counseling. We didn't see that in Iraq, but here you can see the most of the Iraqis need the counseling.
When you think about going back to Iraq, it must be both something you're looking forward to, but also something that's terrifying to you because of these problems are going to go back with you.
All the Iraqis here, every one of them has a case that don't enable them to come back to Iraq. But all of us wish if we can come back to Iraq. It is better for us, place or country. But because of the bad situation now, and most of them know that they will not stay alive there, they are waiting to get the immigration to another place or to wait here. It's very difficult. About myself, I am a lonely one from my family that I left Iraq. And of course, because of that, like the most of the Iraqis, they treated us. They wanted us to work with one of the militias, and we refused. Because of that, we had to left Iraq. And now I didn't see my family since more than 4 years, my mother, my sisters, my brothers. I wish to see them, but what can we do?
You hear from them?
They are always in danger. And always we talk with them by internet or by mobiles. Uh-huh. But the situation is very bad there. The same bad situation. But sometimes when we see in the channels, on the TV, on in the news, we think that the situation is better. But when we call them, they tell us always it's still bad and the same thing.
Are they in Baghdad, Maha?
No, my family in Al-Mosul. But we know many families and friends in Baghdad because I have been in Baghdad for the last 7 years before I came to Jordan.
Do you have a sense of what people in Iraq are saying about the current U.S. plan to pull the troops out of your country?
They hope to be better with Obama, but most of the Iraqis know that not only person who can change. It is a big problem, and by many hands who want to make that to continue with this war.
And also there's the Iranian influence that's, you know, really a large problem in Iraq. I think what most Americans don't know is that the current government in Baghdad is a lot of Iranians and Iranian sympathizers. People with no education at all are holding ministry posts. And so, you know, Iran has this imperialistic agenda in place too. And so it's a very complicated issue. This problem is going to continue for a long time once we pull out. But I think it's very important that the United States do pull completely out of Iraq, all troops, not only those who are going to be called advisors and trainers, but also the huge contractor population that's there is equal to the number of troops that are there or more. Because Iraqis cannot take care of their internal problems with that disruptive influence there and with the Americans facilitating Iran's involvement in Iraq.
Pulling out altogether is not on the agenda for the Americans, is it?
No, it never was. So, you know, if you heard Obama say I'm going to end the war, it sounded great. But if you went to his website and went one page back from the main page, he said exactly what he was going to do before he was elected. So I'm not surprised. So I think, you know, many Americans were hungry for change, and that was the byword he used. You know, what we have to do, he is our president now, is we have to same fervor and the same dedication and the same pressure that we had, you know, under the Bush administration. One thing that I've noticed is that starting late last summer with the build-up to the election with the campaign and then the election, and then, of course, Americans are preoccupied with their own economic situation now, and then the travesty in Gaza, the Iraqis have been forgotten, but let's not forget the Iraqis who are still suffering under this war and who will continue for a long, long time.
The hard thing to deal with here is that the progressives or the left has decided that the war is over and that we now have to worry about single-payer health care in this country. And so you're right, it's like one thing comes along and it supplants the thing that we were just concentrating on or focused on. And along with that are millions of people being forgotten.
I have to understand that Obama's military budget and the amount of money that's being poured into the occupation, the continuing occupation of Iraq, could be used domestically to provide Americans with the things they need and to try to rebuild our economy. So, you know, we can kill two birds with one stone by focusing, you know, continuing our focus and our pressure on the U.S. to pull out of Iraq, and also then, you know, we could see the benefits of that domestically.
It makes total common sense, but it's a very hard one to get over here.
So. Yes, it is. But all of us who understand that, you know, need to keep our voices loud and clear and constant to spread that message.
Sasha and Maha, how can listeners get in touch with you, or how can they help out through the Collateral Repair Project?
Well, you can go to our website, and it's quite long. It's www.collateralrepairproject.org. I'm also keeping a blog from Jordan, and that's www.collateralrepairproject.blogspot.com. And we certainly could use cash donations, even small cash donations. Like I said, we buy food for a family for under $20 a month. Contact your representatives and tell them, you know, about this situation and to consider funding, more funding to help Iraqis both here and in Syria, but also to speed up resettlement for those who cannot return to Iraq because the death threats are still waiting for them as they always were and will be. What I'd like to say is Iraqis also are very aware. The media here is much better than what we have in the U.S., and they see our demonstrations. So let's get out there and show our forces and give Iraqis the understanding that we are there with them and we haven't forgotten them.
Great to have you, Sasha Crow and Mahai from Collateral Repair Project. Is there anything you'd like to add before we end?
Yes, I want only to thank you, and I want to thank all the American people who always used to help us to assist us through the collateral repair project, because really we need them, their assistance now. There are many persons in America who refused this war and happened inside Iraq and for the refugees out Iraq.
That was Sasha Crowe and Maha in Amman, Jordan, with the organization Collateral Repair Project, describing the situation for Iraqi refugees in that country. Learn more about the Collateral Repair Project and read the personal stories on their website, www.collateralrepairproject.org. There's also a blog that you can read if you go to the website, www.collateralrepairproject.blogspot.com. And find ways that you can get involved. Remember, a little goes a very long way under these circumstances. I made reference earlier in this program about my book, which is coming out soon, and it is called Long Time Passing, Mothers Speak About War and Terror. In it, I share the verbatim stories of people, predominantly women, but not only, in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, West Bank, Afghanistan, and the United States. And we will be having an event, a book tour event, on April 28th, so mark your calendars. It will be at Grace Cathedral's Gershom Hall. It's 1100 California. It will be on April 28th, which is a Tuesday. Doors open at 6:30, and between 6:30 and 7, we will be having a reception with food and artwork from Iraqi children and local artists, including myself. At 7 o'clock, the event begins, and we will be raising the voices of some of the women in the book. We'll have some Afghan women with us. We'll have some local American women with us. Rachel Avila, Mary Tillman, Asma Eshin, Rahima Haya will all be saying a few words about their collaboration in the book. And then I will be also signing books. And you can find out more about that by going to the website, which is www.motherspeakaboutwarandterror.org, motherspeakaboutwarandterror.org, and you can also purchase the book from the website, but if you go to www.motherspeakaboutwarandterror.org, you will find a lot of information, but also contact information if you want to know more. So that's Tuesday, April 28th, 6:30, Grace Cathedral's Gershom Hall. It'd be great to meet you, and come and introduce yourself if you're a regular listener. That's our show for today. As usual, all views expressed are those of the host and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week when we will continue bringing the voices of ordinary people to Raising Sand Radio.